This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Conservative talk radio host Rush Limbaugh died of lung cancer this week. He'd been battling cancer for the past year, sharing details about his treatment sporadically with his millions of listeners. Limbaugh began hosting in the mid-80s. The 1987 repeal of the FCC's Fairness Doctrine let him cement his conservative brand. We've heard some retrospectives this week on The Takeaway and from NPR News. Now we'll hear from two voices in the radio business. Limbaugh's views were often controversial, even offensive, but in many ways his style and commercial success changed radio forever. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about Limbaugh's career, influence, his show, and his legacy on American politics and media? Call in now at 800-642-1234. Charlie Sykes is the founder and editor-at-large of The Bulwark. Charlie Sykes previously hosted talk radio for quite a while here in Wisconsin. Charlie, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
And also with us, Michael Harrison, editor and publisher of Talkers, a trade magazine for talk radio. Michael, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you as well.
Before we get into the content of Limbaugh's show, Michael, I mean, you follow the talk industry. Rush Limbaugh really defined this whole genre of political talk, especially conservative talk. Can you talk about how he just changed the radio landscape?
Well, he turned radio, talk radio, from being a very small part of radio. It was a sideshow. He was instrumental in it becoming the major format in radio. Spoken word radio dominates radio on all sides of the spectrum, and both public and commercial radio. He was a major component in syndication becoming as big as it has. He also changed the nature of how radio is now categorized, talk radio, conservative talk radio, liberal talk radio, how it's categorized by politics and political ideology, as opposed to, you know, an array of curmudgeonly unique personalities that didn't fall into any kind of category. They were basically unpredictable. So he's changed the nature of the business. But even more importantly, he was instrumental in saving the AM dial from obsolescence and saving radio from obsolescence. In the late 20th century, radio was on the wane, and now radio is a major iconic institution in terms of American communications, just as it was back in the early days of radio.
And Charlie, you were in this same generic category of conservative talk radio host. But as you recently wrote in the Washington Post, you didn't see yourself necessarily doing the same things that Rush Limbaugh was doing. What concerned you about his approach to radio?
Well, before we get to that, I mean, I want to just emphasize what Michael just said. I mean, it's really impossible to overstate the impact of Rush Limbaugh, both on the conservative media and on American politics. He was not, of course, the first conservative talk show host, but he really, in effect, he invented this new genre of the political talk show and really transformed conservative politics as well, not just in the media, because he really pioneered the growth and the dominance of the entertainment wing of the Republican Party. So there's no history either of the media or of what's happened to American conservatism that doesn't have Rush Limbaugh playing a major, major role. In fact, when I wrote that piece for the Post, I started off saying, how big was Rush Limbaugh? Well, we are all living in the world that Rush Limbaugh created pretty much in his own image, because so much of what we talk about in American politics can be traced back to what Rush Limbaugh did.
And again, you were disappointed in some of the directions he took that, Charlie.
Yes. No, I was on the air for about 20 years, and I admired his technique and his talent. He was a major talent. But I became increasingly troubled by some of the directions he was taking, and then eventually appalled. You know, I had to go back and look at some of the tapes and transcripts. And in the beginning, I think he was playful and he was having a lot of fun and he had the parodies. And over time, though, I think the show became leaned more heavily into outrage and grievance, and many of the kinds of rhetorical techniques that we see in Donald Trump. I mean, you would not have had Donald Trump or his style of politics without Limbaugh clearing the ground for him.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Manny is with us in Madison. Manny, hello.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What'd you want to bring up, Manny?
So I'm from Sacramento, and I met a guy that worked at NPR in Sacramento. A great gentleman, but he actually worked with Rush Limbaugh back when Rush Limbaugh was doing radio in Sacramento, Northern California. And one of the things he brought up to me, he says, Rush actually didn't have great ratings. He wasn't even all that conservative. But because his ratings were falling, he didn't really find an audience. He started shifting to the right, actually threw out some more inflammatory statements, and that's when his audience got stuck on there, and that's when he kind of took off. And so this man was convinced that Rush Limbaugh actually just started as an act, that he wasn't even feeling with the things that he was saying. But, I mean, nowadays I would assume that he even just kind of went into it, the character, and just molded into the character.
Manny, thanks for the call. Michael, I don't know if we can really separate where Rush Limbaugh as a personal thinker was versus Rush Limbaugh, his on-air character.
Well, that's something that everybody in the media should think about. I mean, as a person telling you what they think you want to hear, I call that the daily dance of affirmation. It's like a radio station playing the kind of music that people want to hear. And if there's a vacuum in the market, you fill it. Talk has become that way to a certain degree. But I always felt that Rush Limbaugh was sincere about what he felt. It just became more intense as his power and his influence grew and as he saw what aspects of his personality succeeded. He was discovering himself. He wasn't sitting there going, what can I do to get ratings? He was finding what aspects of his own personality, his own experience worked. His whole show was an experiment. But there is a story arc, and I know Charlie will agree with this, and it's fascinating. When Rush started back in the late 80s after the repeal of the Fairness Doctrine, he was sort of like a right-wing version of Jon Stewart. He was a satirist. He was a comedian. Mm-hmm. He was funny, but he was very provocative. And as he began to get traction and people took him seriously, he became more serious. And he went from being entertaining to being engaging. And you'll notice that we don't use the word entertaining as much. We use the word engagement here in 2021 because entertaining means telling jokes, being dirty, being silly, yucking it up. Engagement is the modern version of entertainment, and he became more engaging. I wonder if Charlie would agree with that.
Yeah, Charlie, what do you think?
That's an interesting take. I think in order to understand Limbaugh, I mean, he was actually very open at various times in his career that he was, in fact, an entertainer. And by the way, I'm not disagreeing with the entertainment engagement distinction, but that he said, listen, you know, I don't have a political agenda. You know, I'm a radio guy and I'm concerned about radio metrics. And this is the thing, looking back on his career, that Rush Limbaugh was really not that interested in ideas the way it sounded. He was always a performer and it was always about the show. So, you know, people in the conservative movement who think of Rush Limbaugh as this great thought leader, I think misunderstand it, because here was somebody who was very attuned to his audience. And I think increasingly later, in his later years, he was more of a follower, going where his people were going, scrambling to keep up with them and the changes on the right, as opposed to leading the group. And so, you know, there were strengths and there were weaknesses. And I just have to say that one of the things about Rush Limbaugh was that he normalized many of the things that I think we see as part of our politics, the way that he would drift into rationalizing conspiracy theories, the way that he cultivated a certain blunt insensitivity that joked about things like racism and sexism. That really did change the culture and the tone of our politics. And I think in the end, not necessarily for the better.
We're taking a look at conservative talk radio host Rush Limbaugh's legacy with longtime Wisconsin radio host Charlie Sykes and with Michael Harrison from Talkers Magazine. Limbaugh passed away this week. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and questions. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're looking at the impact that radio host Rush Limbaugh had on American media and Republican politics. Charlie Sykes stays with us, former talk radio host here in the state, now founder and editor-at-large of The Bulwark, and Michael Harrison, editor and publisher of Talkers, a trade magazine for talk radio. And with you, let's go back to your calls. Steve is with us in Sun Prairie. Steve, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. You know, Rush gave voice to people like me who were right of center, who had no place to go. You know, pretty much every news organization and entertainment venue has become liberal. And he provided a funny way to push back on some of the conspiracy theories of the left, such as, you know, white supremacy being this huge issue, that there's a patriarchy. So he gave voice to that. So I look at him like a Bill Maher, or someone mentioned Jon Stewart, but he gave voice. So we got to thank him for allowing us to have some entertainment that's not dominated by liberals.
Steve, thanks for the call. Charlie, this is something you hear from Republican politicians who think back to their earlier days listening to Rush Limbaugh.
Well, I know that Michael could obviously add to this as well, but I certainly remember in the late 80s and the early 90s that it was like pouring water on parched sand. There were people out there who were not being served by the rest of the media. And what Limbaugh did was to help identify the existence of this audience, which was huge and which did feel alienated from the rest of the media. So to a lot of, to a large extent, the legacy media needs to look itself in the mirror and say, what did we do that created the conditions for so many people to go to the AM radio dial, which was basically abandoned by then, to find that? But I heard that over and over and over again at the time. I guess what was unfortunate is that because he built this huge community of ditto heads, that with that great power came great responsibility. And I'm sorry to say that I don't think that he always lived up to that responsibility. And I think that he could have taken our politics in a more positive direction, and he chose to sometimes appeal to the worst angels of our nature.
And Michael, your thoughts on Limbaugh capturing that, finding that audience that was untapped by many sources?
There's no question that Charlie hit it right on the head. I mean, that is what happened. The liberal media didn't think of itself as liberal. It thought of itself as centrist and mainstream. And anything that was right of center was marginalized in pejorative terms. They call them right-wing wackos, extremists, far right, with a little bit of an edge to the way it was said. And, card-carrying conservatives felt that they were disenfranchised by the general media culture. And whereas people ask me, how come liberalism didn't make it as big on commercial talk radio? Because card-carrying liberals didn't walk around with grievance. They didn't feel that they were being persecuted. Plus, there's a different makeup to the conservative person at that time in the late 80s and a liberal person. A liberal could be any number of different lifestyles, ethnicities, economic categories, whereas conservatives had a lot more of a targetable sameness. They were a targetable audience from the standpoint of how radio operates. Limbaugh tapped into that.
And Charlie, as we wrap up, that grievance that Michael was just talking about, do you think that focusing on that has been a big factor in our divided politics? Is there a way to come back for that while still having people who argue and get listened to argue for conservative values?
It is a huge part of what we're going through right now. And this was one of the things. Limbaugh was not the only person to do it, but he turned political opponents into enemies. And that became part of the drumbeat, that the people on the other side were not just wrong in their position, but that they were evil, they were dangerous, and they needed to be defeated. And that's the kind of politics that has become dominant on the right. And, you know, keep in mind how influential Limbaugh was in creating this vast ecosystem. You think of all of the other talkers who would not be on the air had it not been for Limbaugh. But also the impact it had on Donald Trump. People wonder, when Donald Trump said certain things, when he engages in certain kinds of rhetoric or behavior, why do conservatives continue to go along with it? Why are they amused by it? Why do they tolerate it? And part of the reason is that for 20, 30 years, Limbaugh softened them up for it and normalized that kind of behavior. So, yes, the outrage, grievance, us versus them, tribal politics, was really is unfortunately one of his legacies.
We'll leave it there for now. Charlie, thanks for joining us again.
Thank you.
And Michael, thanks for being with us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Been talking to Charlie Sykes, founder and editor-at-large of The Bulwark, longtime radio host in Wisconsin, and Michael Harrison, editor and publisher of Talkers, a trade magazine for talk radio. They join us for a look at the influence and legacy of Rush Limbaugh, who died this week of lung cancer. After the news, the CDC isn't recommending it, but if you need to travel, here are some things you need to know about being tested, getting vaccinated, and so on. We'll look at the state of travel now and in the future. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. After the idea was kicked around by the Biden administration, the CDC is not recommending mandatory COVID-19 testing for domestic travel, for now anyway. It's an idea that wasn't sitting too well with airlines and travel groups. They said it would further hurt an ailing industry. Even though the CDC isn't requiring that testing, traveling isn't always straightforward right now. There may be some unexpected rules and regulations along the way. And when it comes to international travel, some countries, including most of Europe, aren't allowing people from the U.S. at all. Other countries are only permitting travel if you've been vaccinated. So getting around is a tricky thing these days, and so is planning for future vacations. Deborah Dunn is travel editor of the Wall Street Journal. Debbie, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much.
And Barbara Peterson is a contributor to the Wall Street Journal and author of Blue Streak, Inside JetBlue, the upstart that rocked an industry. Barbara, welcome back to you as well.
Great to be here.
Right now, in general, the CDC says, hey, let's stay home as much as we can to limit the spread of COVID-19. Barbara, for people who do fly, what is flying like these days?
Well, more people are flying, but keep in mind, too, that it's still way down from what it would be normally, about 70% down from the previous year. So fewer people are flying, but also there are fewer planes in the air. So there have been anecdotal reports of planes getting a little fuller. But other than that, it's business as usual, except, of course, everybody wears a mask. There are some airlines, at least, are trying to keep the middle seat open. Only one airline at this point is guaranteeing that you can get an empty seat next to you. But we have heard some news that flights for future flights, in other words, bookings are picking up.
That's getting there. Now, Debbie, once we get somewhere, especially internationally, there might be a lot of little wrinkles and surprises for people thinking about traveling now or in the next few months. What kind of, apart from health concerns, what kind of red flags should they be thinking about before they book anything?
Yeah, it's really tricky. Well, one, I mean, there are not a lot of countries still. I mean, countries are opening up and not too many are welcoming Americans quite yet. And the ones that do, you know, the State Department and the CDC are both warning against traveling. And again, like you say, not just for COVID, but because these foreign governments can change their regulations at very last minute, right? So that could really put a damper on any kind of itinerary you have planned. And you could get stuck somewhere and maybe even have a hard time catching a flight back. So unfortunately, it's still pretty messy internationally.
Let's amplify that getting stuck somewhere concept, Debbie, because sometimes you might be able to travel to a place, but there might be some kind of testing required before you can get on a plane to come back.
Well, you absolutely. So that was a new requirement from the State Department in January. You have to be tested before you come back to the U.S. And depending on where you're going, it may not be that easy to find a test. That's true. And some places, you know, are countering that. They're offering some hotel resorts are offering on-site testing to try to lure travelers, but it's still pretty risky.
And Barbara, for domestic or international, I mean, are we testing people before they get on planes, or has that been something that people have been trying?
Well, yes, and people were worried that was going to be the next step. But that is not happening. And it's probably unlikely that it will, in part because, you know, the vaccine rollout is underway. It's not going as fast, I think, as some people had hoped, but it is continuing apace. So that plus the fact that, you know, a lot of people are just getting used to this ritual of getting a COVID test 3 days before you depart somewhere. Now, the airlines in the United States, just to be clear, the domestic flights do not require that. It's really the destination you're flying to that you have to worry about. And so there are all sorts of different ways you can get the test, and then you have to also be concerned you're getting the right kind of test. Now, Hawaii is a very good example of this. Of course, Hawaii is a top tourist destination. They, for a while, had a mandatory quarantine. But that was really hurting their tourism business. Now, if you can get the test within 72 hours, you can travel there as a tourist. However, you must get the right kind of test. You have to check with the department of that individual state. So travelers just need to really keep on top of all the myriad restrictions. And they really do vary state by state.
Talking to Barbara Peterson and Deborah Dunn, travel writers, both affiliated with the Wall Street Journal, looking at the current and future state of travel amidst the pandemic. Barbara, you mentioned we're seeing bookings picking up for future travel. What kind of time horizon do people seem to have in mind for when they're willing to try to book future air travel?
Well, that really depends on whom you ask. I'm sorry to answer it that way, but it's some people are itching to really get out of town. I mean, I think, you know, we've had almost a year of a COVID lockdown type of mentality that we're living with. And I think it's just some people have finally said, I just need to get out of Dodge. Especially if you've received a vaccine, I think you're feeling more secure about going. You're not so worried about picking it up from a stranger that you might be sitting next to or something. So we're hearing positive things about the summer and fall. And maybe even some people before then. I mean, you know, I think there may be some spring travel too. But as far as a return to what we'd consider really a normal travel pace, I think that's going to be looking more towards the end of the year.
And Debbie, I'm like a lot of people. I would love to travel someday again. What kind of time horizon are you seeing people try to plan a trip for? Are they thinking, okay, I'm going to book something for late summer? Or are they thinking, all right, 2022, I'm going to do this thing? Like, where are people like me pinning their tacks in the calendar? Who pins a tack in a calendar? Making marks on their calendar.
Yeah, I think that's exact. I think late summer is exactly right. So that seems to be kind of the safest bet, late summer, early fall, and that's maybe even closer in. So I think a lot of people think maybe Europe really won't be that accessible until the end of the year, possibly even next year. I hate to say that, but that could be. It'd be a nice surprise if it opens up sooner. But I think otherwise, it's looking pretty good for late summer and fall.
And Debbie, I've heard the idea floated. I don't know if anyone's actually doing this. Vaccine passports, or if you can prove that you've gotten both shots or the one shot and some of the ones coming down the pipe, if you can prove you're fully vaccinated, that might make travel easier. Is that a reality now?
It's not quite a reality. I think it's gaining a groundswell of support. I think there are a lot of people very interested in that idea. I think there's some legal challenges. I know some of the cruise lines are talking about that now, right? I think Crystal Cruises just announced that they would only take people who have documentation of both vaccinations. And I think as more companies kind of jump on that bandwagon, it'll become more prevalent.
Now, Barbara, and
yes, if I can just add to that, yeah, definitely. And I think that there are apps being developed that some of the airlines are backing. And I mentioned Hawaii earlier. Hawaii just this week came out and said that probably as of May, they're going to allow anybody from the mainland who can show proof that they've been vaccinated to come on the islands without any testing involved. So I think we're going to see more and more of that happening very soon.
And Barbara, people of a speculative bent who think, hey, maybe I can get a deal if I book advanced air travel. These airlines have got to be desperate to sell me something right now. Are there bargains to be had for buying future airfares?
Yeah, so you would think it would be a sort of a distress sale environment right now. And it is true, you can find some good deals. But I would caution people not to assume that because, first of all, the airlines are really hurting, as we know. They're trying to, bring in some more revenue so they can stay afloat. So I think it's a very tricky balance, between demand and supply. And if planes start to fill up, that doesn't necessarily mean they're going to bring some of those planes that are in mothballs back on, on service. So they may decide that, well, let's create a little scarcity and see what happens. So I wouldn't bank on that. I would say, though, that it's definitely a good idea to book well in advance. So if you're thinking of going somewhere in the fall or, you know, the winter holidays, you should really not waste any time. Get going. And if you book something now and then your plans change, you will be able to get your money back or get a voucher towards future travel. So I think that anxiety that existed before is over, because the airlines had to really, up their game in that department.
And Debbie, we had a comment from Susan on the Ideas Network Facebook page who says, "We'd like to travel, but are waiting to see what's advised post-COVID vaccine. When will it be safe if those we want to visit aren't vaccinated? Do we still wear masks no matter what? Do we still social distance? Do we still quarantine before and after?" What kind of things would you say to Susan and the many people who I think are sharing those exact concerns?
Yeah, that is a tough one. I mean, I think that it's sort of been proven right now, at least the vaccine will protect you. So you won't have to worry about falling ill. But there's still, a minute possibility that you could be transmitting the disease. So if you're visiting people who don't have COVID, who don't have the vaccination, then yeah, I think all of the regular, the masks, the social distancing, I think that still applies. And I think actually wearing the mask will probably be with us until the whole world is vaccinated. That'll be with us for a while, long time yet.
And as we start to wrap up, Barbara, what are you watching for next in this pretty fluid situation, especially when it comes to air travel?
Yes, well, I'm looking for more destinations that are really going to be opening up and welcoming Americans. So international travel, which has really been totally shut down. I mean, that's just dead. That would be really the jump starting of it will happen when countries and destinations around the world say, okay, now, you're not just we're going to let you in, but really encouraging people to come. And then that will, of course, produce more flights and more frequencies. And I think that's what we need to start seeing. We need to start seeing more airlines adding more planes on and just generally, get moving in, in that direction. I do think that we've been really fortunate that we haven't seen an airline failure. I think that was a concern at the outset. So as long as we've got an airline business that's, not in risk of, having a rash of bankruptcies, we're doing okay. In fact, it really is better than a lot of people thought a year ago. But I think for now, it's a little bit of wait and see, and I think that comment from your listener really touches on it. It's actually sort of partly a psychological thing. When are people going to feel really comfortable about going? That's going to be the determinant.
We'll leave it there. Barbara, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you.
And Debbie, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks a lot.
Barbara Peterson is a contributor to The Wall Street Journal and author of Blue Streak, Inside JetBlue, The Upstart That Rocked an Industry. And Deborah Dunn is travel editor at The Wall Street Journal. We talked about the state of travel and the travel industry 1 year into the pandemic.